I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing conversations of I just got back from Southern California, where I went to Encinitas, as I tend to do, not quite where I grew up. I grew up a little bit south of it, north of San Diego. And in Encinitas, there's a self-realization fellowship set up by Paramahansa Yogananda in the late 30s, 40s. And so it's this great big, weird Indian dome on the cliffs of this Southern California beach town. And it's kind of become sort of the icon of the town, or one of the icons of the town. There's a great break out there called Swami's, named, of course, for, though he wasn't really a Swami, that was the nickname of Yogananda. And you see the image of this building on a lot of the kind of tourist iconography of Encinitas, et cetera. It's part of the identity of the town. And it's a funny one for me because, I grew up seeing this thing regularly. And the hard part to communicate is that while the novelty of it is part of what has made it an icon of the town, it's this odd kind of piece of, Hindustani architecture in the middle of Southern California. For us growing up, it was kind of normal. Like it wasn't actually really any more exotic than, some beach hotel or a local Catholic church. In fact, I can't really think of many churches in the area that were really visible, that really stuck in my mind, that had interesting architecture. So in some ways, it was just kind of like the local church. And there's something interesting about that, which is that what happens to people like me and millions in my generation and the generations after me, who grow up kind of in the shadow of this curious turn that so many people in the West took towards Eastern religion, going back as early to the days of Yogananda, but really exploding in the 1960s and especially the 1970s. And this has led to a lot of people with these very curious backgrounds where, they're living normal postmodern lives, confused, trying to deal with the internet, trying to make money, worried about the environment. And you find out that they, grew up in a commune or even a cult, to make a distinction that many would quibble about. But people who grew up in these alternative situations, some of which were running on very unusual ideas about what the nature of reality was, what the purpose of life was, what the structure of the family was. And so there's this whole host of people, many of whom I've had the pleasure to meet, because I find it a very interesting thing to talk to people who grow up in these environments, because they're, and on the one hand, it's whatever they're doing, whatever, sadhanas or rituals or practices or meditations or, teaching experiences that they have growing up are very unusual compared to the kinds of things that I had growing up in kind of normal public high school. But on the other hand, it was also just normal because that's what was happening. That's what you and your friends were experiencing. It's just part of reality. It's not a big deal. So there's this strange kind of mix of being kind of normal, not normal, inside, outside. I have one friend who grew up and his father was the guru, who was like a Shaktipat guru and, Muktananda's lineage. And he grew up on the ashram and he was like the guy's son. And it's like so hard to wrap my head around. I've been trying to get him on the show. At some point, perhaps I'll be able to lure him to talk about it, but we'll probably end up talking about philosophy in any case. But it's a fascinating thing. And it was with that fascination that I turned to Claire Hoffman's new book, Greetings from Utopia Park, which is her story of growing up inside the transcendental meditation world of the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, one of the most famous gurus of the 60s and 70s. He was the guru for the Beatles, for Mike Love of the Beach Boys, and currently the figure behind the meditation practice so strongly promoted by the director David Lynch. Claire grew up in this community, and she just published this book, which is a memoir of growing up and her very interesting relationship to this part of her life as an adult. and talks about her return in a certain way to some of the practices and experiences that she had rejected as a teenager, as do so many people growing up both in unusual religious situations and Christian situations. You know, a lot of the same kinds of issues come up, people who are raised a Catholic or raised a Baptist, and then at some point they break away, often around a similar point in adolescence. And that's Claire's experience too in many ways. But with no further ado, I want to welcome Claire Hoffman to Expanding Mind. How are you doing, Claire?
I'm doing good, Eric. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no problem. You know, it was a really, really fun reading your book and seeing how you chose to frame the story and tell the story. I mean, you're a professional journalist and have worked for Rolling Stone and taught journalism, so you have a lot of awareness about the issues that are raised when you tell stories and how you present material. And I thought it was very interesting to see some of the decisions you made about how to present this. You know, but it's still a challenging thing to decide to write a memoir, especially when there are other people involved, your dad, your mom, your brother, who don't always come off so great, or at least it's, you know, they're complicated stories, they're tender stories. So, you know, you needed to have a real motivation to take this on and to run the gauntlets that writing about personal material does. What was it that really drove you to say, look, those are difficulties, but we can face them and we can, you know, go forward to make this project worth the effort?
I think I have probably in the last decade started to feel, you know, almost kind of evangelical about the idea that religion and spirituality should be something that's talked about in a more complicated way and in a more sort of a way that acknowledges all the contradictions that exist within it and within people who themselves consider themselves spiritual or religious or who don't and who make that choice. And I think I had felt like what I was hearing from friends and in graduate school was this conversation that felt really black and white, like you were part of a religious group or you weren't. You were a believer or you were a non-believer. You know, the people who believed things that were crazy, you know, like that those people were illogical. And I had this perspective from where I grew up that was much more complicated and nuanced, and there was a lot of contradictions within it. You know, I mean, I grew up in a community that had a lot of really unusual and strange beliefs, but I know from having lived through it that those beliefs felt true and valuable. And even though I don't believe those things anymore, I'm interested in that experience and what it was like to have the world be kind of shaped by this vision. And so I think like that kind of idea about like these sort of the contradictions of belief and the power of belief really made me want to write the story. You know, I think on top of that, transcendental meditation has really come back into the public eye in a big way. I mean, there's not like a celebrity in Hollywood now who doesn't talk about how great it is and how it's transformed their lives. It's become it's really returned to pop culture. And I think I wanted to kind of complicate it a little bit. You know, I think there's this instinct in some ways left over from my mom's generation where it's like, Eastern religion equals pure and true. You know, for people who are rejecting the Western religion that they grew up in, they're like, well, you know, Eastern religion, Eastern philosophy, like, has some sort of purity to it. And I kind of wanted to, like, muddy those waters a little bit. Not that it's bad. It's not a, like, I escaped from this community book, but that it's, you know, that people are people and complicated things happen.
Yeah, there's a lot to say there. Just to make a comment about the contemporary scene, it is interesting as someone who has studied the stuff and came up not so closely bound up with it as you did, but it was always part of my upbringing in Southern California. There were a lot of religious practices around, a lot of hippies, a lot of things that I dipped my toes into as a teenager and later as a seeker. But I've always had this kind of critical attitude as well. So the kind of approach you're talking about is very much along my own lines and really the lines of this podcast. But it is interesting to see now as these things really come back, you know, so many points of sort of the mystical 70s have returned in new glossy formats. from, you know, yoga to TM to, you know, there's now a sort of upsurge in interest in new age music from the 70s and early 80s. And there's this, it's just so strange to try to read it. Is this a sign of a culture that's becoming less ironic, of a pop culture that's becoming less ironic and more open to these multiple dimensions of human life? But along with that, there's also a kind of, there is a kind of naivete or a kind of forgetting. You know, if you know the, you know, if you're interested in this history, just even from the 70s forward, of course, there's all sorts of very complicated and sometimes rather harrowing tales that go along with this turn to the East. So it's a really great time for a story like yours, which is complicated, but also not black and white. Even it's not a conclusion that anybody can really, you know, hang their hat on. It's sort of like welcome to the conundrum, you know, which is I think a great way to
an alternate title.
You know, we talked about your mom's generation. What were the reasons that your mother had, the personal reasons, the things in her life that led her to make this really deep plunge that was, you know, became an important part of her life for a very long time?
Well, yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think for her, it was experience, and it's probably true for a lot of the people who became part of the TM movement. You know, she had grown up Roman Catholic and in a pretty strict household, pretty theoretical, a lot of big sort of black and white ideas about heaven and hell and sin and guilt. And those weighed heavily on her household. And I think she saw a lot of hypocrisy there and kind of just wanted to get away from it. And she went away to college. She grew up in Princeton, and she went away to college at the University of Colorado Boulder. She was a skier and, you know, took a TM class, went to a lecture, took a course. And for her, it really was experience. Like, she just immediately felt this incredible transcendence in meditating and, you know, this, like, sense of, like, this is who I am, like, really connecting to a sense of self that she had been looking for up until then. So initially, you know, it was really just about the meditation practice, as it so often is, you know. It was about that feeling and experience and sort of a shift in her consciousness, for want of a better term. And then, you know, over time, it became about the ideas and the philosophy that Maharishi, you know, the guru, was espousing. And then it became about the community, and it became about the movement and the teaching and that sense of belonging. But initially, you know, it was the experience, which I think you see now. You know, people are having experiences and then looking to kind of build out, you know, a lifestyle or a philosophy around it.
Yeah, I think that's a really key element. I mean, that's something that's been important, particularly to that generation and the ones that have come after it, in terms of really putting experience front and center, you know, partly because everything else is, who knows what's true? Who knows what the right way to think about the world is? But at least I know I did have this experience, and it does seem to conform with what I'm being told, at least, you know, maybe, or what the picture is that I'm getting from this immediate context where I learned the technique that gave me the experience. And it's something that happens, we see, you know, over and over again. And you know, one of my ideas, and I'd love to hear you riff on particularly TM and that meditation method and the one that you learned as a kid. And, you know, one of the most interesting threads of your book is how your experience of this meditation changed, what it was like for you as a kid, when it was something that was kind of normal, sort of, not that, you know, just part of your ordinary life running around as a kid, and then it becomes these different things as you go forward. And then and when you revise or look again at your own experiences as an adult, it's really important as well. And so, you know, what is it about your own, what have you learned about the way experience in meditation works from your own experience of growing up with it as something normal, as something that you just do as part of being a kid in school, to now as an adult seeing the way that meditation can take all of these different forms in different religious traditions and indeed in popular culture today?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great and complicated question.
Sorry about that. I do that sometimes.
No. It's super interesting. I haven't actually quite thought about it like that, and it makes me think about a lot of different things. I mean, I think, you know, my first sort of blanket statement would be that, you know, I mean, my meditations are, you know, I've been meditating now. I learned when I was 3, and I'm 39, so I've been meditating 36 years, and my meditations now are great. They're better than they've ever been. And I think the factors for that are, you know, that I need it. I really need it now. I know it, I need it, and it's mine. It's not something dictated by anyone else. I make my own choices about how long I meditate, if I meditate at all, if I meditate twice a day. Those are all my choices. So it's very personal. And I seek it out, and it's there for me. So it's a real kind of one-to-one relationship. As a kid, you know, meditation was something that, you know, there were a couple of different aspects of it. I mean, on one hand, it felt magical, and like this, you know, I was sort of told that it gave you these superpowers, and I felt that and experienced it. I felt the separateness a little bit from the world around me, which was a good thing given how chaotic stuff was. And I felt, like I had this sort of retreat within myself, you know, a quiet place that I really identified who I was. You know, over time living in this community, meditation became, you know, a duty, and to the extent that, you know, there was a period in school, you know, we were meditating twice a day at the Marishi school, where they were grading it. It was something you had to do. It was something that when I was home on the weekends, you know, it was time to go meditate, and I, you know, would go do it. And then as I got older, I would sort of not do it and be sneaky about not doing it. And it was a way to be subversive. So I've kind of like run through all those experiences, and I almost don't have an answer, because now I have kids and I really would like them to meditate. But, you know, I taught my older daughter learned to meditate when she was 4, and, you know, we came home after she got her mantra, and I was like, okay, great. Like, you should go meditate. And, she said no. And I was like, oh man, like I can't make her do it. I can't make her do it knowing what I've been through. And, you know, this is a kid who I make take piano lessons, because I know that even though you don't playing piano that much as a kid, it's going to be really valuable to you when you grow up. And I feel kind of clear and fine about making that choice with her about something sort of, you know, frivolous like piano. Like, I don't really care if I ruin piano for her, but I care about ruining meditation for her. So I don't force it on her, but I don't know if that's the right answer, because, you know, would I be a regular meditator now if I hadn't spent all those years being forced to? I don't know.
To me, that's one of the trickiest issues. I mean, that's a fascinating tension to think about, because you can really, like, that decision about the versus the piano lessons, because you can kind of think about it both ways. You know, it's like, you know that, like, the grind of piano lessons will bear some kind of fruit, even if they don't end up keep playing music. And in a way, right, meditation is, you know, so much more essential, in my opinion, as well, to a rich and balanced and sane life. And yet to force it in the same way has all these kind of consequences and resonances. But to me, it asks a kind of deeper question, I think, is one of the bigger questions I have finishing your book. But just in terms of meditation, it's that oftentimes the practices that end up being most valuable for us, and I have a similar experience of meditation, that's something that I had to learn to make my own, and is now my own in a way that I'm it's sort of impervious to what other people think it should be or could be or whatever, and it's a really wonderful, very intimate part of my life. But then I had to do that by basically, you know, falling in love with different traditions, having weird relationships with people who thought they were teachers or gurus, and some of them were kind of screwed up, being confused, having bad ideas about what it was, but somehow sticking with it. And, you know, in your case, you can look back at a situation and you can say, look, there was, you know, a lot of positive things that came out of it. But it was sort of a weird scene. The organization was kind of corrupt in some ways. There was a lot of people who were being, you know, whatever, I don't want to say hoodwinked or fooled, but there was, you know, there was some real problems with it as an organization. And yet, perhaps on some level, we need organizations like we need things that are kind of not perfect, if not actually kind of deeply flawed, in order to sort of convince people or encourage them that it's worth it to start doing these kinds of practices, which then down the line can flourish into something that's really personal and powerful. But it's hard to do that from the get-go. So it's a real contradiction. It's like, do we need religion with all its flaws in order to enculture people so that later on they can kind of define it and claim it for themselves? Because if you don't have the religious structure in the first place, they're never going to get going, and then they're just going to be swamped by the busy world. I think that question is one of the things that you've been asking in your book.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's like, it's so interesting to me because, you know, besides TM sort of coming back into the popular culture, there's this thing that I think I found with myself. I mean, besides parenthood, I think one of the things that really drove me back into the arms of meditation was this sort of unforeseeable shift in the way that we live, which is so wire, like this connectivity, where this just constant onslaught of information through your phone, you know, and I'm like a news junkie, but I never watched cable news, but now suddenly, you know, I've got the news all the time on my phone. I've got text messages, got phone calls. I've got email. And that like has really driven me into the arms of meditation because, you know, it's sort of the perfect push away from that is meditation is the space of feeling kind of removed and feeling quietness and feeling a sense of self that isn't all of this kind of like cable ticker mentality. So, you know, as far as the question, you know, I mean, I don't know. Like, I think with meditation, it is different than piano. I think it is, you know, I mean, I think, but I also am, you know, if I'm at a dinner party, I will usually end up being the person who defends religion. You know, I think it gives you things in life that we haven't been able to, replace. Well, you know, I mean, there's people, some people are really systematic and almost invent their own, you know, religion-like way of living. And so maybe those people, you know, can create a superstructure. But for most of us, you know, there's things that get thrown away when you move away from that sort of structure of belief and that prioritization of divinity or consciousness or enlightenment or whatever those things are. I mean, having a community, having a belief system that puts that front and center can, you know, has really powerful and wonderful effects and alters your sense of reality forever. I mean, I do think, you know, my kids are not growing up religious. They're not growing up with any ideas about the universe that are sort of narrative in any way. You know, we talk about science a lot, but they're not getting any of these stories and any of these like questions that religion and philosophy surface. And there's parts of it I'm sad about. And yet at the same time, I cannot belong ever again after what I went through. I really can't. Like, I see the way that these communities ultimately end up being orchestrated and co-opted by people who are interested in power and who, you know, end up, you know, I mean, in our community, everything became commodified, you know, every path, every step to enlightenment became commodified. Everything ended up being for sale and access to enlightenment and power, access to enlightenment became, you know, something that you could buy. And I just see that. I see it everywhere, you know.
Yeah, and your story.
That was a rant.
No, that's fine. No, I mean, and you don't rant, which is part of what makes it interesting, is that you have a very gentle way of telling your story. And it almost seems kind of innocuous sometimes, and then you realize really what you're doing is wrestling with really deep issues, but not doing it in a ranty way. And the attention to economy is really, really, really important, because of course in our era, any sort of religious movement, spiritual movement, meditation movement, anything like that is going to become, once it gains some kind of steam, embroiled in consumer culture and contemporary capitalism and media culture. And in TM's case, you know, it was kind of more noticeable in some ways, because as you tell these various state, you know, suddenly there's an edict about Ayurvedic medicine, and so everyone's got to get on the Ayurvedic health thing, but the way to do it is to buy these products, which are coming down through the organization. But there's an additional level to the economics of it all that comes through your book, which is you know, poignant, which is the fact that your mom was broke and you guys were essentially poor, living in a situation where there was a lot of conspicuous wealth. And so you were kind of forced to grow up and grapple with a kind of caste distinction within the movement that was not at all articulated or really dealt with very well by the movement. And so you came to a certain kind of, you know, political consciousness about how money worked inside these movements that was very unusual. And the one thing I couldn't quite tell, I'm sure there were many reasons that you started to become disenchanted as an adolescent, and started to kind of question, you know, your father's skepticism and his voices in your head. He's a very appealing character who's, you know, partly creating a space for you to think about these, you know, issues like brainwashing or whatever, you know, just a different way of looking at what was going on. But I was curious how much the kind of seeing your mother work so hard and seeing her spend her money on the overpriced Ayurvedic products or whatever it was, how much that really played into your disenchantment as well?
Yeah, I think there wouldn't probably have been a disenchantment without that. I mean, I think seeing my mom just working around the clock and having our existence be so tenuous, and I think that made me question things early on. You know, I mean, to see my mom suffering, you know, like crying at night because, you know, she's not going to be able to afford her badge to go to the dome the next month and do the group meditations. You know, that the protective part of me, you know, the part of me that, like, as a child of a single mother, you end up kind of being the parent for the parent. There was a lot of that with my mom, and I think you know, wanting to protect her and seeing her suffer made me kind of pushed out a little bit from that. And so I think it was the cost. You know, I mean, it really, in the end, the fact that everything had a price tag, and the fact that we were kind of on this inside-outside track, you know, like my brother had to leave the Marishi school and go to the town school, and then he was able to come back through a benefactor. You know, it was just this, like, we were really kind of on a tightrope all the time. You know, we were just sort of barely making it. But not just barely making it in terms of food, which was true, and our rent and our electricity, but also, you know, this larger cosmic reason for being there. And, you know, and you see it in the school that the kids whose parents are giving money just enjoy different privileges or are treated differently. And so there's two things I want to say here, because I think they're important. One of which, you know, kind of it's just an interesting thing, and we talked about it for a second earlier, but this idea of Eastern religion, you know, kind of, or philosophy being this sort of pure construct that people can adopt, and, you know, they think it's sort of like free of all the, you know, clutter and history of Western religion. But, you know, I experienced really firsthand that as much as, you know, TM, they say it's not a religion, there was so much about Maharishi's experience as an Indian man and growing up in the caste system that got trickled down into this community in Iowa that, yes, like 100%. There was so much that was caste-like and inevitable. And so much, there was the caste stuff and there was the gender stuff that just, because we had a guru and our guru was a human being who had come from like a neighborhood and a community with a belief in a caste system, as much as we sort of foregrounded transcendence and talked about that, you know, what we lived and the ideas and the particulars of how to live ended up really looking like a culture that was, you know, beautiful and flawed, you know, and not pure. Like it had a history to it, and it had problems. So I would say that, number one, just to talk about that, because I think it's interesting in terms of, you know, this naivete that you were talking about earlier. And then the only thing I want to just say about the cost and about the commodification and the TM movement that I hope came through with the book, but I'm not sure that it did, is that, you know, there's a real tendency for people who've grown up in the TM movement or who have left it to say, like, oh, Maharishi did this to us. You know, like, he created this, like, belief system, and then there were all these products. Suddenly it was Ayurveda, Astapatra Veda, Gandharva Veda, you know, how to eat, how to heal yourself, how to live, all these things. But I really think that there is an equal, if not stronger, force of the appetite of people to have those things. And he just was, you know, his knowledge was never ending, and he was constantly dispensing things. People would ask for it. They would say, you know, like, oh, is there, you know, a special herb that I can take that will make my meditations better? And it's like, well, sure, here's a recipe. So I do think that there was, you know, I had the sense in finishing the book more than I'd had before I started it, of like, wow, we did this to ourselves. You know, this is not a story of victims. This is a story of people who made choices, and it was our choice to make the community look the way that it did.
Yeah, no, I do think that comes through. It reminds me of something I just watched last night for preparation for this, the documentary David Wants to Fly, which is by this German filmmaker, David Sivaking, who becomes interested in David Lynch and becomes interested in TM and then becomes kind of disenchanted with it. And there's a wonderful interview at the end with the Maharishi's biggest benefactor. I can't remember his name right now. The fellow
Earl Kaplan. Yeah.
And so they're interviewing him, and he's interviewing him, and he tells a story. Kaplan, who's not the disenchanted benefactor, tells this story about how there was always this idea in the movement that all you need is to get, you know, whatever, 7,000 people meditating in one place and there would be world peace. And so he gives all this money to make that happen. And at a certain point, he's like, why isn't this happening? Da, 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 da. And he has a conversation with the Maharishi, and he goes, well, didn't you say that, like, all we need is 7,000 people meditating to have world peace? And the Maharishi goes, like, I don't know if that's going to happen. I don't know if that's true. And it's this wonderful moment when you see inside, you know, what it's like to be one of these guys where, for whatever reason, they start something going, it takes off. Maybe they believe their own stuff for part of the time. But unless they're insane, which some of them maybe technically are, but unless they're insane, then they know that they're kind of making it up, sort of, and that, you know, that's good, sort of, for people because they need it, because for the reasons you're saying, they want it. They want these strictures. They want these truths. They want these answers. And so then they're in this weird place of, like, kind of fabricating things that are good for people. And that is a whole head trip that a lot of spiritual leaders get into as well, who aren't megalomaniacal. And so for me, that was a beautiful moment, because you could see Kaplan going on the one hand, oh my God, you're a total fraud. But on the other hand, a more mature reaction is the one that you are talking about, where you're like, wow, look how we all agreed to have these very specific goals or very specific truths because we all wanted them. It was a very interesting moment when it's like the wizard in the Wizard of Oz, you know.
There's definitely, with Maharishi, a Wizard of Oz thing going. That's pretty strong. I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, part of when you asked me, I think your first question was about why, you know, why write a memoir and have these, you know, my family be a characters in it and kind of put a lot of the personal stuff out there. The other thing that I just felt like was an important idea to me was I saw, you know, my parents both came from pretty, like, screwed up families. There was divorce and alcoholism and suicide and depression on both sides. And, you know, I mean, my great grandparents were divorced. So it's like a real, all the way down, real lineage. And, you know, I saw how TM or religion was this like answer, this salvo of like, you know, to turn away from the darkness to the light. And Maharishi was such a big part of that, where he embodied to my mother and the people in the community this perfection, this sort of like beyond humanness. You know, he was without flaw and without complexity. He was, you know, pure being. He was, you know, he was enlightened and omniscient, and he was all the things that their past wasn't. And I think I feel that you don't get these sort of gurus without that desire of people to get away from themselves. You know, that sort of self-loathing for their humanness and their flaws and their complexity and the past and their darkness and their shadows. You don't create these gurus who are going to feed you all the answers without that sense of, I don't know, like self-criticism or self-loathing. I think it's a real symbiotic relationship. And so, you know, I mean, my mom wasn't thrilled about some of that personal stuff about my grandparents being in the book, but I felt like if I were going to lay out the math problem that equaled Maharishi and a group of people living in Iowa believing in a mathematical formula that involves levitating and world peace, and most of those people having college or graduate degrees, you have to go back to this sort of, you know, repressed and shadowy family history. Like, it's absolutely a part of it.
Well, it's the same point you're making about Maharishi himself, is that you really can't understand what happened without understanding his own history, you know, his own caste position, which, where he's not a Brahmin, he's not really supposed to be a guru, you know, and he has his guru, and at some point he kind of, you know, cuts bait and makes his own story going. And so, I mean, he's got, it's just funny, you know, being a student of this stuff, how much, you know, you don't get full answers, but you get so much context by understanding things historically, you know, including personal history and the influences that lead individuals to have that. And it also creates a lot more compassion. I mean, that's what's so hard with, you know, you talk about being usually the one at the table who's defending religion, and I'm in a similar boat. Most of the people I know are secular, and some of them are quite critical of religion, and I have a much more complicated relationship with it. And you know, and part of it comes down to you really having compassion for the reasons that people deal with the absurdities and contradictions of life in religious ways sometimes. You know, I mean, there's all sorts of ways to do it. And one of them is to, you know, really invest in certain viewpoints that are really counter normative. But I also want to give a little space to how weird some of this stuff was in terms of, you know, the TM meditation that we were most familiar with is not so weird. You know, you get a mantra, it's a secret mantra, it's a syllable. You close your eyes for 10 minutes or 20 minutes twice a day, and you repeat the mantra, and it you know, helps provide, you know, all these sorts of boons. But the whole levitation flying thing is, you know, takes us into another zone. And that's something that you turn to towards the end when you want to kind of hook up with this lineage again and have your own experience of that. You don't just talk about your, you know, daily TM-inspired meditation, but you go to a flying class. So since that's such an outlandish part of the story for people from the outside, could you just talk a little bit about how flying was presented, like when you were a kid growing up, and the whole idea of it, and your mother was practicing it, and how your understanding of it, you know, grew up. But then also, why is that an important thing now? Like, what is it about the whole trip that makes that still an important part to acknowledge, even in your own experience?
Yeah, I mean, so growing up, I mean, as early as I can remember, you know, I mean, we were living in the Upper West Side of New York, and I remember my mom, I mean, that's where I learned to meditate. And I remember my mom talking about how, you know, that people could levitate and Maharishi could levitate and how she wanted to learn how to fly. Like, that was a very early thing, wanting to learn how to fly. And when we moved to Iowa, I think that was sort of the big idea that we would go there and we would be part of a group of people who were flying and my mom would learn how to fly. And, you know, I mean, my image of that is probably what any kid's image of that would be, you know, is that my mom would be like soaring around the room. And so, you know, when we moved to Fairfield in 1983, and I was just sort of on the cusp of turning 6 years old, and, you know, somebody donated the money for my mom to take the flying course, which cost thousands of dollars, and she had to be away from us for 2 weeks, which was tough since my dad had just sort of disappeared one day from our lives. So it was a hard thing for us at that point. And, you know, my mom would talk about flying after that as just like the most groovy thing in the whole world. It was the best feeling. Once I was at the Maharishi school, you know, I heard more about this idea that Maharishi had come up with, that he called it the Maharishi effect, or the 7,000 effect, which was that if the square root of 1% of the population practiced his advanced form of meditation, aka levitation, then it would create world peace. And he had this all sort of scientifically validated. He had all these studies done. There were lots of graphs and charts that were always up on the walls at school about how this process worked and was scientifically proven. So, you know, and then when I was probably 10 or 11 years old, I saw it for the first time. The Maharishi decided to make it public, and I saw a demonstration. Just to back up, you know, so in Fairfield, people would gather, men and women would gather in these two gender-segregated golden dome buildings in the morning and in the evening for about 90 minutes to 2 hours twice a day and practice group meditation with this belief that it was creating world peace, but also that it would allow them to, it was sort of a super highway to higher states of consciousness beyond just the transcendental meditation. So they would go there. My mom would be gone about 3 to 4 hours a day meditating in these groups. And that was really the core of the community where these group meditations still in many ways is. So I saw the yogic flying when I was about 10 years old, and it was really kind of like awkward and silly looking and messy and human and not at all magical and superpowered. And that was a real sort of moment of doubt, sort of the beginning of doubt for me. And, you know, I would say I became pretty cynical about it as a teenager. I learned, you know, probably in my 20s as a student in divinity school and as a journalist, you know, went back and did more reading and learned about how, you know, Maharishi had, you know, I mean, he'd really been an incredible entrepreneur and businessman. And, you know, in the 70s, the early 70s, TM was just immensely popular. You know, there was some significant portion of the American population that had learned his transcendental meditation technique. So he kind of introduced like the next level. I think he introduced it in 1975 or 77. I'm blanking on that right now. But he, you know, cities, the TM city technique, which is what it was called, you know, it sort of literally translates into superpowers. And it comes from the Yoga Sutras by Patanjali. It's an ancient technique that's sort of out there and in books. But because Maharishi was this sort of enlightened seer, it was his trademarked course that would give you these abilities. And there's amazing kind of crazy stories of the time of the CIA trying to infiltrate and like learn mind powers and, you know, I mean, and people kind of losing their minds doing it and them trying all these different kinds of ancient techniques and him really landing on levitation as like the one, although there's the TM City program involves a bunch of different sutras that are supposed to do other things besides that. But flying was the big one. And that really changed the course of the movement. It had been really mainstream until then. And when he introduced levitation, it really, it lost a lot of people, not surprisingly. And, you know, but this core of people who believed it, you know, sort of followed his vision of moving to Iowa, where he'd bought this bankrupt university in order to start like a Maharishi university, but also to have these group meditations. And, you know, this was going to be the sort of superpowered core of the of his movement, where people were meditating in large groups together and, you know, creating world peace. So that is sort of the backstory.
Yeah. I just want to ask one question before you go on, which is, why do you think he made that move? Like, you have this very successful mainstreaming of meditation to American society in the 70s, or Western society in the 70s. It's a remarkably branded, thought about, and effective method. It's clearly working for a lot of people, not just to create just random experiences, but they're feeling the effects in their life. And it's accessible. It doesn't go against Western scientific ideas, et cetera, which was very important to him to present these things in terms of science. Why do you think he went into this more esoteric direction of talking about the cities and stuff, which is in all of these Eastern traditions and often gets sort of swept aside in the more mainstream Western presentations of these teachings, but they all have them. Why do you think he kind of made that turn towards a more esoteric or fully mystical view of these powers?
I mean, it's only a guess. You know, I don't know. My guess would be that he did it because people wanted it. You know, I think the people that I know, like my mom's friends from the movement from those early days that I grew up with. I mean, it's such a specific group, but like really now, you know, the ones that are kind of, you know, mad at Maharishi and sort of pissed off about the movement are like, you know, he said we were going to be enlightened in 10 years. You know, they were like, we thought we were going to be living in cosmic consciousness. Like, he lied. Which is so crazy to me that I just don't relate to that at all. It's like so odd. Like it's a whole thing that I can't even get on board with. But I think that he, you know, he sort of had people asking him like, hey, you know, like I want to go deeper. I want my meditations to be stronger. I want to fast track to enlightenment. And so he, you know, went back to his books or, you know, his training with his guru and was like, oh, okay, like, here's this. And then there's probably the businessman part of him where it's like, okay, great, you know, the TM technique costs $35 to learn. What if I have something that's super awesome that's $3,500? So that would probably be another idea that I would layer in there. I do... As cynical as I am, Eric, I think I probably do believe that Maharishi believed everything he said a lot of the time.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Like, I'm not so callous that I think he was some sort of, like, 40-year manipulator who was just, like, chuckling in the back room counting his gold. And I'm not saying he didn't chuckle or count his gold, but I think that, you know, he was in it, too, and he believed in himself the way that people believed in him.
Yeah, that comes through.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
So I would just say, to wrap up the flying thing, you know, I went back 5 years ago after my daughter had turned one, and I took the flying course myself. And I think it came from a place of, you know, feeling really lost after having my daughter, feeling like a strange sort of loss of identity, a sense of like really looking for meaning and structure in my life in a way that I hadn't needed it before. I think before that, like, ambition and career had really just filled in that space for me, and it didn't anymore. And I felt a real like desire to you know, have this magic and meaning in my daughter's life the way it was in mine. And as much as I didn't really believe in the flying sutras, I've always, you know, wanted to see for myself what it felt like. You know, I knew what it looked like, but I wanted to see what it felt like. And, you know, not to, like, give away the whole book, but it ended up being a really powerful experience for me. And it did change my life in some ways doing it, although probably not in the way that they would have prescribed, the administrators of the course. But it did lead to, like, a real deepening of my meditation and kind of a reconciliation for me of a lot of the ideas that I grew up with. Not the ideas, but a lot of the experience, like wanting those experiences in my life and empathy for my mom and like an understanding of where she was coming from and the power of that experience. But that's, you know, it's also not something, like, I'm not advocating people go take the course. So that's me on flying. If that makes any sense.
No, I mean, again, I don't want to, I mean, because that is an important part in the narrative of the book, but it is interesting, you know, it must have taken some guts for you to talk about that experience, because it's one thing to say, oh, I was away on an insight retreat or a yoga retreat and had this experience and it was really powerful and it sort of changed my life. It's like, everyone's like, yeah, whatever. But to say, yeah, I went to the Maharishi Flying School and we were, you know, basically hopping, flying, whatever you want to call it. And I had this altered state and it ended up being really powerful for me across time. And now in my present life, that takes more guts. I guess I am a little curious about that, about just, in a way, is that part of almost, I don't want to say the appeal of it, but there's, in a way, you're suggesting that, and you even use this word absurd in the end of the book. Mm-hmm. You talk about, were we just being fools growing up and all this stuff? And clearly people can make an argument that you were, that your mother was, mm-hmm. that people were fools. They were being hoodwinked. They were being milked of money, blah, blah, blah. We all know that. Typical cynical rationalist story. But then you suggest that there is an element of the absurd in all this, and that, you know, however much we want to point to neuroscience and talk about mindfulness, blah, 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 there's something else going on here that's larger and weirder and more absurd, that is also in some ways part of the magic or part of the possibility of it. I'd love to just hear you talk a little bit more about that, about the way that you see the absurd or the impossible functioning inside of this kind of seeking or these kinds of experiences.
Yeah. I mean, that, I think that is, like, the most interesting stuff, you know. I mean, it's just so fascinating. I think, you know, I interviewed around the time that I was working on the book, or maybe right before. This was right after I'd done the flying course, just for a story I was working on. I ended up interviewing a TV writer who also happened to be Orthodox Jewish. And we talked about how, you know, I mean, really, like, unrelated religious traditions, but how to have sublime or cosmic or divine experiences, you do have to let go of logic. You know, this was something he said, and I really agree with. You know, I think that you, as far as I can tell, like, I think that there's the part of your mind that is logical and rational can only take you so far. And the experience of me learning to fly, and I'm just going to use that term loosely, learning to fly, but also my sort of understanding of the world afterwards and the experience I had from it, really reminds me of, like, being in seventh or eighth grade at a school dance, you know. And it's like, you can be the cool kid on the side of the room who is looking out at the kids dancing and thinking, like, they look awkward, they look dorky, you know, why are they making those faces while they're dancing? Like, you can judge them and be critical, and you can be right, you know. Like, if you turned off the music, they would look like fools. But for the people on the dance floor, they're having the greatest time, and they're experiencing they're experiencing something you can't experience on the side of the room. And you, there's a part of you where you have to drop that criticism and that, like, judgment and just kind of let yourself go in order to have that experience of, you know, having a great dance party. And, I mean, it's not a perfect analogy, but I think there's something to that of, like, you know, you kind of have to be willing to look stupid or do crazy stuff in order to have these other experiences. And I think, you know, in terms of, like, having guts or whatever, like, I think I started to feel really trapped by the logic of and cynicism of my own world. You know, like, I sort of felt like, you know, like, this is, I felt trapped on the side of the room, I would say. You know, like, I felt like I had made myself stuck. And, you know, I, like, feel grumpy about hippies and people who read New Age books more than probably anyone on the planet. And yet, like, I didn't want to be sitting on the side of the room.
Yeah, I think those are really key points you brought up. I mean, there's something very fearful about that rationalist stance. My working philosophy has been to, in these situations, you know, follow my interests. And when I have the opportunity to have an experience, go for the experience. You know, when I go into an Eastern Orthodox church, I'm fully ready for the icons to speak to me, even though I'm not a Christian in that sense. And I've had those experiences. And it turns out that on the other side of them, I've now had these wonderful experiences that are not what the institution wants me to have, but also are not what the skeptics or the religious critics would have me have either. And it turns out that my reason bounces back, but more supplely, more with more room, more malleable, but it's still my reason. And it seems like you have found your own way to carve out and be both of those things in your life and in your writing too, which in some ways is tougher to come out and talk about these things in our current polarized climate.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the work of Tanya Lerman?
Yes. I've had her on the show. She's a great person. I really like her her work on When God Talks Back, and all of her stuff actually has been really great. But you know what? I'm just getting the word that we're done with this interview. Time has arrived. So Claire Hoffman, thanks so much for being us an Expanding Mind. This was a great chat.
Thank you, Eric. I love talking to you.
Okay, great. Well, good luck with the book.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
All right, and for all you folks out there listening, keep your minds open.